My message tonight is entitled The Messiah's Manifesto. As we look through the book of Isaiah, there are four sections in there which are referred to as the servants' songs. The sections in Isaiah where it talks about this special servant of the Lord. And we learn something of the character and the work that the servant's going to carry out. One of those sections is in Isaiah 42. It's really, the servant song just covers the first four verses, but we're going to look at the first seven there. So if you've got a Bible handy, if you'd like to turn to Isaiah chapter 42, we're just going to have a look at a few verses. Just give you a chance to get through to that. So Isaiah 42 and the first seven verses, and this is what it says. Here is my servant whom I uphold, my chosen one in whom I delight. I will put my spirit on him, and he will bring justice to the nations. He will not shout or cry out or raise his voice in the streets. A bruised reed he will not break, and a smouldering wick he will not snuff out. In faithfulness he will bring forth justice. He will not falter or be disgraced till he establishes justice on earth. In his teaching, the islands, will put their hope. This is what God, the Lord, says, the creator of heavens who stretches them out, who spreads out the earth with all that springs from it, who gives breath to its people and life to those who walk on it. I, the Lord, have called you in righteousness. I will take hold of your hand. I will keep you and make you to be a covenant for the people and a light for the Gentiles. To open eyes that are blind, to free captives from prison, and to release from the dungeon those who sit in darkness. And in this, it tells us that the servant of God, will be, first of all, aided by God, then he'll be approved by God, and he will be anointed by the Spirit of God. It tells us that the servant will be the bringer of justice to the nations. Now, the Jews had the idea that bringing of justice to the nations meant paying them back for how they treated Israel. And their idea of bringing justice was, retribution. They were going to be avenged on their oppressors. However, God's ideas were different. He talked to his servant not coming with grand announcement, but coming with gentleness, tenderness. Coming to those whose lives were just hanging by a slender thread, and that he would rescue them. This servant would be a faithful bringer of justice to all and for all, because the servant of God will also never be extinguished or become broken to the point of extinction himself. And the servant himself would be the covenant. The servant would be the one who gives light, sight, and liberty to everybody. And as I say, this is the Messiah's manifesto. When Jesus came, he showed that he was a servant, and he delivered this manifesto at the synagogue in Nazareth. If you'd like to turn to Luke chapter 4, we're just going to look at the section where Jesus is given, it says, the scroll or the book, and he begins to read. In verse 18, this is what it says. The Spirit of the Lord is on me because he has anointed me to proclaim good news to the poor. He sent me to proclaim freedom for the prisoners and recovery of sight to the blind, to set the oppressed free, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor. Now, I don't know whether you've ever compared that. If you have a look at the notes, it says this is taken from Isaiah 61. Also says that there's a little bit interjected in there from Isaiah 58, because what Jesus has done is he's taken a section from Isaiah 61, he's missed some portions out of it, and he's introduced a section from Isaiah 58. And this is how it is actually made up. The Spirit of the Lord is on me because he has anointed me to proclaim good news to the poor, and he has sent me to, is Isaiah 61. At that point, he misses out the bind up the brokenhearted, and he continues to say, proclaim freedom for the prisoners It then introduces, apart from Isaiah 58, where it says a recovery of sight to the blind, to set the oppressed free. And then it goes back to proclaim the year of the Lord's favour. So Jesus uses sections from Isaiah 58, verse 6, Isaiah 68, 1 to 2, and edits some of the readings from Isaiah 61. But the question is, why? Jesus uses these to show God would repay, well, the nations and the Romans for their domination, but he would do more. He wouldn't just be coming to smash that setup. He'd be coming to establish a new kingdom. Jesus sent to proclaim and do a different task from that the Jews expected. He comes to give light, sight, and liberty to everybody. Easter Sunday, Resurrection Day, it's the completion of this part of the Messianic Manifesto. The resurrection shows who he was, who he is. The resurrection showed a new way. Jesus showed the way to freedom in John 8, 31, 32, and verse 36. It says, to the Jews who believed him, Jesus said, if you hold to my teaching, you're really my disciples. Then you will know the truth, and the truth will set you free. And then 38, if the Son sets you free, you will be free indeed, really free. More freedom than you could ever hope for. More freedom than you ever knew that you needed. And by his resurrection, he gained freedom for the prisoners. He was affirmed through his resurrection as the Son of God. The prisoners were those who were accused. Us, charges against them and us, debts owed legitimately to God. And what Jesus brings here is not a jailbreak. It's not a plan that fools the guard. We're not tunneling out, but the price of release is fully paid and the prisoners are led out in victory. Jesus brings freedom for the oppressed, liberty for those who have been dominated through no fault of their own, simply that they are less powerful, the ones who are holding sway over them. Because someone who has come has more power than the one holding them. One with even more greater power breaks the oppressor and leads the oppressed out in victory. And what we're going to have a look at tonight are some different aspects of the freedom that Jesus brings. The first is that Jesus brings freedom from sin and its control. In Acts 13:39, this is what it says. Through him, everyone who believes is set free from every sin, a justification you were not able to obtain under the law of Moses. The law showed how to be acceptable to God. It also demonstrated through people's inability that whilst it may be perfect, people are not. It showed the extent that was required, and we demonstrated quite clearly an inability to obtain that. As far as we were concerned, the acceptable way to God is unobtainable. They and we, everyone, needs assistance. It's sometimes said that a wise person knows when they need help. You know, sometimes we can be playing with Esther, out for a walk or at home or something like that. She's maybe doing a painting or something. And sometimes she'll say, I can do this all by myself. Sometimes she can, sometimes she can't. But she wants to give it a try. There are other times when she needs to climb up somewhere, she needs steadying, she needs help, and she says, help me. And that's wise. And we need to demonstrate wisdom by knowing when we need to call for help. Romans 6, 5 to 7 says this, for if we've been united with him in a death like his, we will certainly also be united with him in a resurrection like his. For we know that our old self was crucified with him so that the body ruled by sin might be done away with, that we should no longer be slaves to sin, because anyone who has died has been set free from sin. It's extreme, but it's certainly effective, because being dead means that we're not in that life anymore. It liberates us from that life, its debt, and everything that's owed. Debts are cancelled, duties are cancelled. We're set free, and it no longer has control over us. In Romans 6:20, it says, when you were slaves to sin, you were free from the control of righteousness. And the fact is, vice versa is true. If we're slaves, servants of God, then we're no longer under the control of sin. We're no longer living that life. We're being freed from its control altogether. But we're also told that that death is not the end of the road. In Romans 8:2, it says, because through Christ Jesus, the law of the Spirit who gives life has set you free from the law of sin and death. And the Spirit who liberates us from the life of sin liberates us from death. Now, if you've been in any church for any length of time, the Christian theory that I've just been telling you should seem like old hat. You've come across it many times before, you've heard it. But there are at least two problems. The first one is this. The life of sin, acting how we wanted to, is what we used to. There was one time when I was coming home from work, coming home on the bike along a particular stretch of road that I'd travelled many years, having worked there for a good many years this year. Oh, sorry, last year was 42 years. So I knew the journey very well. This particular stretch of road, it had a 40-mile-an-hour stretch. That was followed by a 60-mile-an-hour stretch. At the end of that was a 30-mile-an-hour stretch as we entered built-up area again. And I got into the habit of coming along the 40-mile-an-hour stretch and then using the superior acceleration of the bike as we went into the 60-mile-an-hour stretch to overtake any cars that were in the way. And there was one night when I was coming home, there were a couple of cars in front of me. We were going along in the 40-mile-an-hour zone. And we came to the 60, and I accelerated and passed them. And as I passed them, it's then that I actually took notice of the speed limit sign that I knew so very well, that was the standard delimiter sign, the white circle with the black diagonal through it. Except as I went past it, it wasn't the delimiter sign. It wasn't the sign saying you can now do 60 mile an hour. It had been changed for a 40 mile an hour sign. Now, I knew that road so very well. I knew the sign so very well. And yet I didn't see the sign until I actually passed it because I was so used to traveling along that road. As it happened, when I got to the end of that stretch and got to the 30 mile an hour stretch, I looked back over my shoulder and it was still showing 60. And what was happening, in the signs were actually being changed that day while we were there. But the problem was, I was used to it. I was used to that 60 mile an hour stretch. And, you know, we get used to our old lives. We don't have to think about it. We know how to act. Our ways are a worn path. It's natural. It's what everybody's taught us. It's what we've seen. It's been demonstrated to us. We know how to live. But that's the old way of living. We need to be reading our Bibles that tell us what to do, because they will open our eyes. We need to be sensitive to what the Spirit's saying to us, because he will speak to us, and we should never ignore his prompting. We should listen to that pang of conscience, that feeling of shame, that feeling of guilt, that feeling of embarrassment from behavior, which we now regret. Don't ignore, don't push it away. Listen to what God's saying. Change the path. Don't drop into the usual way of doing things. Make a new path. In 2 Corinthians 3:17, it says this. Now the Lord is the Spirit. And where the Spirit of the Lord is, there is freedom. But to bring freedom, the Spirit must be Lord. He must be the one who's directing us. He must be the one who's leading us. He must be the one who's giving us the way to act and react. And to be honest, our reactions are harder than our actions, because actions we can plan. Reactions just come straight to us. So one problem is we're used to living that old way. But there's another problem. We've got a taste for living the way we did, and we actually enjoy it. You know, people get a taste for sugar. We love it. And the more we get, the more we want. When I had my first drink of tea, it was made for me by my dad, and he made it for me the way he made it. And that was with 3 heaped teaspoons full of sugar. Whoa, it nearly blew my brains out the first time I tasted it, but I quickly adapted. And for me, that was the way tea had to be. It had to have 3 teaspoons of sugar. And we can get a taste for sin. You know, we can love it when the one who's been getting at us gets their comeuppance. And it's even better if we've arranged it. It feels right. It feels fair. It feels good. It feels natural. And we enjoy the taste. I stopped taking sugar in my tea when I was at work. And the reason I stopped taking sugar in my tea was one simple thing that happened. There was a worker in a university, not in Sheffield, and he'd been working in the chemistry department, and he'd been working with his white lab coat on. And one of the chemicals he'd been working with was cyanide salts. Now, you've probably not come across cyanide salts. That's quite good. But these particular cyanide salts were white. And he got some of these cyanide salts on his white lab coat, so nobody saw them. And he went into his tea room, and he asked for the tea, and as it was being given to him, he reached across to the sugar bowl. As he reached across to the sugar bowl, the sleeve of his coat brushed against the edge of it, and he dropped cyanide salts into the sugar. The people who came after him weren't just putting sugar in their tea. They were putting cyanide in as well. Didn't actually kill anybody, but there were quite a few, I think it was about 15 or 20 people, were seriously ill. You don't need much cyanide. It's a very effective killer. But when I heard that story, I instantly stopped taking sugar in my tea. Not that it was a problem, because we didn't allow people to come into the lab coat, with the lab coats into the tea room, but I didn't want to take the chance. And overnight, I stopped taking sugar in my tea. Because you see, I didn't want to be drinking death. As we partake of sin, no matter how justified we feel about it, no matter how much we may think it's fair, no matter how much we think it's deserved on the other person's part, we're actually drinking death for ourselves. Beware of sin. It's a poison. No matter how good it tastes, it's never a good thing. Proverbs 6:27 says this: can a man scoop fire into his lap without his clothes being burned? And of course, the answer is no. To play with sin is to play with fire, and the end is not good. When we work with God, we will be set free. But we have to give up the poisonous drink of sin. The Messianic Manifesto liberates us from sin and its control. But we have to go hand in hand with God. We don't dally with it. We don't look at it and think, that'd be nice. Because actually, it's fooling us. And if we partake of that, we're drinking death. Another freedom that the Messianic Manifesto promises is freedom from guilt. Now, conscience is a faculty. I guess in modern terms, you'd say conscience is an app. It tells us when we've crossed the line. We're born with a conscience. Children very quickly understand what's right and wrong. But also, consciences are trained. It tells us in 1 Corinthians 8, verse 7, in the Message version, this: in strict logic, then, nothing happened to the meat offered to idols when it was offered up to an idol. It's just like any other meat. I know that, and you know that. But knowing isn't everything. If it becomes everything, some people end up as know-it-alls who treat others as know-nothings. Real knowledge isn't that insensitive. We need to be sensitive to the fact that we're not all at the same level of understanding in this. Some of you have spent your entire lives eating idol meat, and you're sure that there's something bad in the meat, and then that becomes something bad inside of you. An imagination and conscience shaped by these conditions isn't going to change overnight. People who couldn't accept that the meat offered to idols, Paul's saying, have had a conscience that's been shaped over time to a particular belief that that is bad, that it's wrong. And people can be steeped in certain ways, and it can take us away a while to unlearn those things. It can take us a while to be washed clean. You know, there was one time I spilled some printer ink on some jeans, and it took multiple times of washing to actually get that ink out because it's very good. And people's conscience can be just like that. It's stained in, it's deep dyed. They've been trained the wrong way. Paul also warns us about other situations. In 1 Timothy 4:2, it says, such teachings come through hypocritical liars whose consciences have been seared as with a hot iron, seared or cauterized, dead to feeling. The result is that anything goes because they don't feel anything's wrong. And the fact of the matter is, just because we don't feel guilt, it doesn't mean to say that we're not guilty. In 1 Corinthians 4:4, Paul saying this, my conscience is clear, but that does not make me innocent. He goes on to say it's the Lord who sorts that out. But he says, my conscience is clear, but that does not make me innocent. We need a correctly trained conscience. And only a correctly trained conscience is totally trustworthy. When we come to God, when we become aware of our sin, we feel guilt. We become aware of a problem. We feel awkward. We know we've done wrong. And we fear punishment. But Jesus comes to liberate us from a guilty conscience. He's not saying it doesn't matter, because it does. He's saying you are no longer guilty because the debt has been paid. The stain has been removed. Hebrews 10:22 tells us, let us draw near to God with a sincere heart and with the full assurance that faith brings, having our hearts sprinkled to cleanse us from a guilty conscience and having our bodies washed with pure water. God's work is to pay the debt. God's work is to purge our consciences from the guilt that that debt made us feel. Our guilt is removed. And at times our conscience has to learn that that is the case. We need to retrain it. We come with a sincere heart. But the fact of the matter is that it's only when our consciences have been cleared that we can come with full assurance. Being assured that God accepts us. Messianic manifesto liberates us from a guilty conscience. He also frees us from the fear of death. Hebrews 2, 14-15 says this. Since the children have flesh and blood, he too shared in their humanity so that by his death he might break the power of him who holds the power of death, that is the devil, and free those who all their lives were held in slavery by their fear of death. Without Christ, we are lost. Without Christ, the curse of death is on us. Without Christ, we have no hope beyond this life. All we have is a fear, expectation of judgment. But the fact of the matter is that Christ has died and Christ has risen, and he has broken the power of death. But there's more, because it tells us that people are held captive by the fear of death. Now, there's different extents. Some people seem more prepared to take risks than others. But the fact of the matter is, the fear of death is universal. The fear of death can determine our actions. The fear of death can determine our outlook. It can protect, but it can cause great anxiety. And as we look around today, we see that there is great fear of death in our world. Right now, there are many who are terrified to go outside their homes. That's not out of respect for a government directive. That's not out of threat of a police fine. It's not to save the NHS. It's not to save other lives. It's the fear of death for their own lives. A friend of mine, his in-laws, when this corona broke on these shores, instantly isolated because they were terrified. His words were, they were terrified. But you see, that's a naturalistic worldview, a materialistic worldview that says death is the end. You might have seen it on the back of some cars, bumper stickers as they call them. It says, one life, live it. In other words, this is all we've got, so you might as well enjoy it. 1 Corinthians 15:32 sums it up, or sums that view up with these words, let us eat and drink, for tomorrow we die. We find that our children are brainwashed at school with the naturalistic worldview. It's natural to have a fear of death. It's natural to fight for life. It's an imbibed view that this is all that there is. But Christ liberates us from this. He shows that there is more, and that more is transforming. Look what it did to the disciples. In John 20:19, on the evening of the first day of the week, when the disciples were together with the doors locked for fear of the Jewish leaders, Jesus came and stood among them. He showed himself to them. He said, peace be with you. He showed them that he was alive, that heard the rumors through the woman, that heard the rumors through the other women, as Julie read to us, that heard the rumors, but now in front of them, they saw the truth, and that was transforming. It needed Pentecost to empower them to preach, but they were no longer afraid of death. It was almost as if they were saying to the leaders of that time, death? Is that all you've got? And there are instances throughout the years of others running from situations like a pandemic, but Christians running towards it to help. And that's not because the Christians don't value life, but they're prepared to lay it down to help others because they know that death is not the end and the fear of death has been removed. Because Christ has risen, Christ will raise. We've seen one aspect tonight of the Messianic Manifesto. Liberty, freedom. His manifesto pledge is that he will give freedom. And unlike the manifestos that you will find published round about the times of election, you will find that Christ delivers on his promises. He upholds his pledges. We can trust him to deliver. We can trust him to give us light, sight, and liberty for all.